Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Chapter 27, The Centaur and the Sneak. I'll bet you wish you hadn't given up divination now, don't you, Hermione? Asked Parvati, smirking. It was breakfast time, a few days after the sacking of Professor Trelawney, and Parvati was curling her eyelashes around her wand and examining the effect in the back of her spoon. I'm Vanessa Zoltan.
And I'm Matt Potts.
And this is Harry Potter and the Sacred Text. Matt, before we get started, I need to put out a request out there. We need voicemails. And I would like a voicemail specifically about this opening sentence. How is she curling her eyelashes around her wand? Not with her wand, but around her wand. Somebody leave us a voicemail about more than this, please. We love getting voicemails from you. But also please address this, because it confuses me. And I think prepositions matter, everyone. And of course, you can subscribe for ad-free episodes on Apple Podcasts. And then Matt, do you want to tell people what we're talking about on our Every Flavored Bean conversation today?
Today, we're going to talk about snitches and snitching. Culturally, snitching has a bad reputation. And Vanessa and I are going to reflect upon that. We're going to think about, like, why is there this reputation about snitching in our culture? And should there be? What is our position on snitching? Join our Patreon to find out.
I'm being a sneak. Matt, today we are discussing the theme of discernment, and it is your turn to tell a story. What have you got for me?
Yeah, I'm happy to tell the story about discernment, Vanessa, because actually discernment is a pretty important concept in my religious tradition, in Christianity, and especially for ordained people. It's an official process. When you're getting ordained, you have to go through an official administrative process, which is called discernment. And the whole idea is you're trying to figure out what the right path forward for you is. Maybe it's ordained ministry, but maybe it's some other kind of ministry. And the reason why it's a deliberative process is because in many ways, the most obvious way to serve a Christian community might be as the ordained minister, the leader of it, right? But it's not the only way to serve. And so the trick is to try to figure out where you would be best called to serve, right? And so I've been in this kind of almost unending state of discernment since my late teens or early 20s, when I was starting to really seriously think about the process of entering ordained ministry. And it's kind of that process of discernment has followed me through every step of professional decisions I've made. What's the right path forward for me? And it was especially true, when the job I currently have, when it became available, I guess, 5 or 6 years ago now? I don't remember the exact date, right? But the minister of Harvard's University Church became the dean of a divinity school someplace else in the country. And it was kind of a surprise to a lot of people in the Harvard community. And so the job sort of unexpectedly became open. And a few people called me and were like, Matt, you should think about applying for this job. And I learned later that another handful of people nominated me maybe pursuing this job. And so it led to this process of discernment where I was like, is this the job I want? Is this something that I ought to do? And Colette and I talked about it and we reflected upon it. And I talked to some of those colleagues who had nominated me. And I talked to some of the colleagues who recommended me. And I thought about it and, you know, did the discerning thing, which I'd been trained to do ever since I started thinking about ministry. And at the end of that process, like, I decided with a fair amount of confidence that I did not want this job, that I was serving a church down on Cape Cod. Colette was working at the church. The commute was not great coming to Harvard, but I liked our community. I liked where we lived. Everybody seemed happy. My parents were moving to the town where we were living. It just seemed like, all things considered, although the opportunity up here at Harvard was great, all things considered, that was the best place for me. And so in this process of discernment, I had made this decision, right? You know, I told versions of the story on the podcast before, but then when new leadership came to the church I was serving, down at Cape Cod, it was a bad fit. And a lot of what I thought was true about my position there and our position at the church didn't seem true anymore. And that led me to reconsider the Harvard job. It had always been appealing to me. I don't want to give the impression that it only became appealing to me because something else was unappealing, but the fact that that other thing was less appealing made me more seriously consider, okay, what else is there? What other opportunities might there be? It made me return to my discernment and start thinking through what it might mean to move our family from the Cape up to Cambridge and for me to think about the church and its ministry up here in a different way, right? And at the end of that discernment, I started thinking, well, maybe that is the right place for me and for us. And I did throw my hat in the ring in the selection process. And you know, the rest is history. I ended up here.
Yay!
The reason why I tell this story is that I want to fold my etymology corner into this story a little bit. The word discernment comes from a Latin word, a discernere, which just means to separate. Like if you have a mess of things, if you have like Legos on the floor and you want to separate them into their colors, you would discernere them. Like you get them all organized, right? And a lot of what we do, I think, when we make these like monumentous discernment decisions, like what is my path forward? We're trying to sort and separate all the details out, all the things that kind of tangle up in our intuitions and our instincts. We separate them out and we try to make sense of them so we can make an ordered decision, right? But those decisions aren't necessarily final because new information emerges. Like someone might come and dump a new pile of Legos into your pile and you have to do some more sorting. And suddenly the thing that didn't make sense before makes new sense. One of the things about discernment, again, that I've kind of learned from my relationship to this process as a Christian minister is that it's kind of never ending. You might find yourself in situations where you feel more stable, where you're not actively discerning because the place you are feels like it fits. But all of us change and grow and the communities we're in change and grow. And nothing that fits today is going to fit forever. And so part of the process of discernment is also being alert to the possibility that you might need to be discerning again.
Matt, what I love about that story is that I think that it gets to one of the many complicated things about discernment, which is feeling the tension of an unexamined life is not worth living, and all I'm doing is examining my life, and therefore I'm not living it. And that to some extent, what I'm hearing you say is that the moment to pause and live are where the details feel stable for a certain amount of time. And then when someone comes and adds new Legos to your pile, then you're like, oh, okay, it's time to examine again. But that we do get these moments of reprieve when we've sorted all of the Legos. And then, it can be up to us to be like, I'd like to sort them differently. But yeah, that was just, it's a really helpful distinction for me of when I'm in those moments where I'm like, I feel like I've been asking myself the same question over and over again, you know, to be like, okay, let's just admit that the details have stayed the same. So we're going to sit with this for a while. I don't know. There's something about the cyclical nature of discernment that I feel like you've really helped parse out for me.
Yeah. And I think for me also, like, the way I approach decisions is I kind of feel like, okay, after that decision, then everything will stay the same forever because it will be over.
Exactly. And then I'm done.
Yes. And all I need to do is make the right decision, and then I never have to decide again.
Right.
Right? And that's all. Those are often the stakes I put on my decisions. And actually, if you think about the way our lives are, it never goes that way. You know what? It's not like we never said this before. It's the next right thing. Right? Like, you're making a decision for, like, this is the information I have, But it's an illusion thinking that, and therefore it will always be the right decision. Like, we always have to be alert to the possibility that things will change and be receptive to, like, the world suggesting to us that we begin the process of discernment again.
Yep.
Vanessa, you are going to be recapping this chapter.
Sure am.
In a mere 30 seconds.
The whole thing perfectly.
3, 2, 1, go.
So Firenze is now teaching divination, and it's very exciting. And Hermione's like, I don't know, it's not that exciting. And then they have DA practice, and everybody is practicing their Patronuses. And suddenly, Umbridge and Draco are invading the DA practice. And then Harry gets pulled into the office with Marietta Edgecombe, who has told Umbridge about the DA. And Fudge comes, and Dumbledore disappears because he was about to get arrested. Wow, words are not accessible to me today.
I thought that was great.
Okay, Matt, on your mark, get set, go.
So Firenze is the teacher of the prediction thing now, whatever it's called. Oh my gosh, this is going poorly. And he says, humans don't know anything, but this is hard. And then Umbridge just said, Firenze doesn't know what I'm doing. Some things are more important than a job. And then they're at DA practice, and Umbridge and Malfoy come, and Malfoy trips him, and Umbridge takes him, and Dumbledore's like, you should just lie, Harry, but only with his eyes. And then Harry's like, no, actually, I did it. And he stuns everybody, and Kingsley made her lie. And then Dumbledore leaves.
So good. I have terrible.
Was it good? Mates. I feel like the first 10 seconds, I wandered around
perfect.
A little bit, trying to remember what it is that Firenze teaches. Divination. Vanessa, you know, in light of the story I told you about how discernment for many of us is often in the context of like trying to figure out what the best way forward is. Like, part of what you're doing when you do that is trying to anticipate the future.
To divine the future, maybe?
That's right. To divine the future. Like, what will the future be like? And which version of me, which possible version of me, will be happiest in that future?
Sure.
And the story I told showed how when different futures come into relief, you have different ideas about which version of yourself might be happier in them. It's just interesting here that, you know, the first part of this chapter is about Firenze and this divination class. So it's no longer Trelawney. It's no longer up in the tower. It's in a replicated forest situation because Firenze has been banished from his herd, he tells us, for deigning to help the humans. And the kind of dismissiveness of the centaurs towards the humans, you know, we've heard this in previous books. Firenze kind of alludes to it again in this book. It has to do with, like, sort of the unreliability of humans and their kind of fickleness. And he seems to assign this also to Trelawney. Interestingly, he says, you know, she may have seen before, but the little predictions she makes or pretends to make, that's not seeing. He says seeing requires this, like, deep, deep, extended expertise in and of the stars. And, you know, attending to the shape of smoke. And, like, this training, this long training, whereby you can start to see shapes, separate out details one from another to get some sense of what the future holds, right? But the thing that's really, like, maybe most interesting about the whole pedagogical approach of Firenze in the beginning of this chapter is he keeps impressing upon them that, you know, centaur divination is better than human, but it's still super unpredictable. Like, you're still going to be mostly wrong. You're still going to be constantly looking for new information. One of the things the narrator tells us is that Harry thinks to himself that this class is unlike any class he's been in before because the teacher, Firenze, keeps telling him, like, you know, I just told you this, but don't trust it because it could be wrong, right? It really reminds me of the conversations we had in book 4 about the topic of intellectual humility with Professor Van Tongeren from Hope College and the Greater Good Science Center, because this is what intellectual humility is, right? It means doing your best, training yourself to have as much expertise as you can, but being super open to the possibility that you are wrong and that new information may arrive, which will change your opinion. And it's interesting because Firenze, that he says that's what divination is. That's what discerning the future is. It means being open to new information. And this is the thing that Harry has never heard before from any human teacher.
Yeah.
And it's so telling that this is why the centaurs are so dismissive of human knowledge and wisdom.
Yeah, that nobody has ever said to the kids before, part of being a good student is actually questioning.
Yeah, that's right. You might be wrong.
Yeah.
Right. And so might I. Like, that's a teacher has never said to you, this might be wrong. Let's talk about it. Right.
Yeah, I love thinking about divination in terms of discernment. Because when we are attempting to discern things, that is what we're trying to do. We're trying to divine the future. We're trying to look at the Legos in front of us and sort them in order to figure out what the best possible option is for us, you know, within our limited control. And I love that Firenze is like, look, this isn't doable, but I find it's important, or at least how we think about it is important. And therefore, I'm going to dedicate my life and actually sacrifice a great deal in order to teach you all about it. It is weird to me. Do you have a theory as to why he is dedicating his life to this thing that he doesn't think is real? Like, I'm kind of likening it to a doctor on a cutting edge of like a new medical technology who's like, we don't know if this works yet, but it's super important to try. But that metaphor doesn't seem perfect to me.
I mean, it seems to me that, especially from previous books, we're meant to think that Firenze has more of a concern for the order of things in the human realm than other centaurs, right? Like, I think he, like the rest of his herd, see that the humans are in a time of relative calm between two periods of intense war. And this comes to the question of discernment again, right? I think the other centaurs are like, let the humans fight their wars. It won't impact us. But Firenze is saying, I don't know that it won't impact us. And I don't know that we ought to just stand by when an evil of this magnitude is coming to the world. And so he feels some obligation to support the humans as they exit this period of kind of illusory peace and return to this period of intense war. So I think that's why he wants to do it. I think that's why he's willing to make the sacrifices. You name that too is an act of discernment, right?
Yeah.
And this is maybe the important thing about discernment, right? He has seen the same future that the other centaurs have seen, but he's decided to make a different decision. He has separated out what the implications might be for him and for others differently than them. And so he's decided to do something differently and to get on the side of Dumbledore.
I love it when people see a big problem and then figure out an exact way that their skills and gifts can help address the problem. And Firenze, right, like, is obviously someone who's in this position who's like, okay, the humans need help here. And there's an open teaching position for a thing that I know how to do, right? Like, there's literally a call for me, someone with my exact skills, in a way that can like really frustrate Umbridge, right? Like, he's really fully seizing this moment. And we see the extent to which he is a discerning person, because he doesn't quite do the same thing with Hagrid, right?
Yeah.
He fully inserts himself into this job at Hogwarts, right? And yet he holds Harry behind in order to tell Harry that he thinks that Harry should tell Hagrid that Hagrid should stop working with Grop, right? But in a coded way. But he doesn't fully insert himself. He's not friends with Hagrid. He's not welcome into the forest right now. He gives his opinion through a friend. Firenze is someone who's very good at discerning right-sizedness, right? Like, This job was written for me. It comes at tremendous risk, but it was written for me and this matters to me, so I'm going to take the risk. Helping Hagrid also takes tremendous risk, and that's actually not a task that was written for me, so I'm not going to do it.
Yeah, I think that's right, but I think that also this question of like seeing the same details or predicting the risks of possible futures against what our own role in that's going to be, like, that is also a question of discernment, right? I mean, I'm being a little abstract, but just to be more concrete about it, right? What Firenze says to Harry is, tell Hagrid it's not working. Now, we as readers who have been through this book before know we've been seeing Hagrid all beat up and injured every time with new wounds. What we learn later on in this book is that he has been kind of trying to take care of his half-brother, Grop, and he's doing it because he wants to retain this connection to this one giant and have a potential ally in the coming war, in addition to like cultivating this relationship. He has an affection for monstrous creatures, and he also has an affection for his brother, right? And so there are all kinds of reasons why he's doing it, but he's separated out the pieces. He's discerned and said, like, you know what? It's worth it to me to do this. Firenze doesn't see the worth of it. Frenzy sees the possible futures. It seems too risky. He has discerned that Hagrid shouldn't do it, but Hagrid doesn't seem oblivious to all these risks. There's this lovely thing that Hagrid says to Harry, which is, there's things more important than keeping a job, right? He knows exactly the risks he's taking. He knows that he might lose his job. He knows that he's coming under suspicion because of how beat up he is all the time. And he's like, yep, those are the risks. But of the possible future paths I see, which are very similar to the ones Frenzy sees, this is what I need to do, right? And so, like, Frenzy can't actually put himself in Hagrid's position. He can give him those details, give him that information, and it sounds like he has, but Hagrid still has to make the decision, and Hagrid is the one who decides what risks are worth taking for which futures he anticipates.
Yeah. I mean, you can't discern for other people, right?
Yeah, right.
And I think that one of the things that's so beautiful about this moment with Hagrid is, I guess there are two things. One is that Firenze says, like, I always have really admired Hagrid's relationship with non-human creatures. And I love that Firenze sees that in Hagrid. But I also love that Hagrid is well aware of the consequences, because I just think it makes the gesture so much more meaningful to, like, have a deep understanding of what the potential consequences are. And yeah, it means that he's discerning and not just like making a decision emotionally and not just stumbling one foot in front of the other, which are all things that there is a time and a place to just make emotional decisions and to like simply go forward because you have no other option. We have seen Hagrid do that in different phases of his life before, and that is not what he's doing here. And it feels like an important distinction in this case because the stakes are so high.
Yeah. Like you said, you can't discern for somebody else. You can make a pro-con list for somebody else, right? And tell them like all the reasons why and all the reasons why not. But you can't actually tell them how much they care about each of the items on either side of that list.
Exactly. Right?
So you can give information, but the discernment, which is always be connected to like values and like what it's worth to me and what risk I'm willing to take, is always going to come down to the person for whom they are most intimate and most immediate. And that's what Hagrid's doing here. And that's also, you know what, Hagrid just understands. He's not really unsettled at all by this centaur who makes all the predictions, who's, you know, renowned to be the person that sees the future saying it's not going to work. He's just like, well, maybe it won't work, but this is what I got to do. And he has that confidence because he knows what he values. And it's a really great moment from Hagrid.
Yeah. And it's actually interesting how sometimes we can, to some extent, divine that something is quote unquote doomed and feel as though like, what would be worse would be the feeling of me not trying, right? Like, sometimes it really can, even if you kind of know the future, you feel like you have to go through the steps anyway.
Yeah.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com. Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
So you said something, Vanessa, about, you know, making emotional decisions. And it makes me think of the final scene in this chapter. Dumbledore's army has been found out. The students have scattered. Harry, while running away, is tripped up by Malfoy, and Umbridge catches him and takes him to the headmaster's office. And when she and Harry get there, Fudge is there, and McGonagall's there, and Kingsley Shacklebolt is there from the ministry, presumably with Fudge. And Dumbledore's there, plus all the portraits of former headmasters on the walls. And there is this kind of like quasi-hearing or trial where Fudge and Umbridge try to get the truth out of Harry. And they bring in Mariette Edgecombe, who is covering her face and is weeping because the hex that Hermione put on her has taken its effect. And it seems like she's afraid it'll get worse if she says more. And There's all this urgency. Everything has come to a head. There is not a lot of time to make careful decisions. You know, it's not like me in the story I told where I get to talk to colleagues and talk to mentors and talk to peers and talk to, you know, Colette and people I care about in my life and try to figure out what could be the best path, right? And not even like what Friends is doing with Hagrid, where Hagrid has already kind of thought through this and all the implications. This is like, we need to decide now. And a bunch of people make split-second decisions, like Dumbledore shakes his head at Harry very subtly to kind of tell him that he ought to lie. And Shacklebolt makes a split-second decision to put an Imperius curse on Marietta, right? And then Dumbledore makes a split-second decision to take the fall. And McGonagall makes a split-second decision to protect Marietta and Harry while Dumbledore is stunning everybody else in the room. The question I have for you is, like, what's the relationship between split-second decisions or intuitions or instincts and something like discernment? My own instinct is that there is something there, but tell me more about what you think the relation is.
I have a very strong theory on this, which is that moments of peace or calm are where you should be practicing the values that you want to come out in you in moments of crisis where you have to go with your gut. And that is why I started a podcast called Harry Potter and the Sacred Text, so we could all practice treating one another as sacred, treating things as sacred, and thinking about these things.
Sounds fascinating.
Yeah. Like, I really believe that. I think that that's all it is, right? The discernment is in discerning what your values are just in your everyday life and how you want to live up to those values in your everyday life in order to be practiced at them when these high stakes, often very quick decisions happen, right? And we see something about Dumbledore here, which is that we don't know why, but like the instinct that comes out in him is protect Harry, right? Like, and that's something beautiful. And maybe it's something else, you know, maybe it's a more strategic decision of like, I can be forgiven in a way that Harry can't. I don't know.
Yeah.
But like, it's very clear with McGonagall. McGonagall has trained herself with 50 years of teaching in students first. That is my job. My job is students first. Kingsley is a trained auror, right? Like, you do what you've got to do in order to get the outcome that you want. And if that means doing an unforgivable curse on a child, then that means doing an unforgivable curse on a child. And like, he, like, is a cop who's been taught that like, these are weapons that you use in order to work on a case. And so I don't always want to hold people accountable for the decisions that they make in these tough moments. I know I don't want to be held accountable for the decisions that I always make in these tough moments. But I do think it's our responsibility to spend our lives discerning so that we can behave as values-based as possible when we get called upon in these moments.
I think that's so right, Vanessa. In every one of these cases, you can see how prior habituation into sorting out one's values has led to the decisions. And like you, like, maybe we don't want to hold people, you have to hold people accountable for their decisions in moments, but you can be understanding that they were split-second decisions maybe after the fact.
Yes, that's a better way of saying that.
Yeah. I mean, that's what's so important about Dumbledore. Dumbledore's a smart guy. But like you were saying, like, maybe there was some strategic four-dimensional chess going on, maybe. But actually, that's the whole point. He's doing four-dimensional chess about strategy all the time, which is why in the moment when there's no time to do it, he's just like, protect Harry.
Yeah.
Right? I don't think he's actually doing the strategy. He's like, you know what? I'm not going to go wrong here if I live into this value. We'll figure out the strategy later.
Yeah, I agree.
And it's also true with Shacklebolt. Like, Shacklebolt's not just a cop. He's also been a double agent for a long time. He has been making these value judgments about when it's right to betray somebody, when it's right to take an action that's underhanded and to violate like what normally goes for integrity. He's making those decisions every day. And so he's able to make one here. Whether it's the right one or wrong one, I'm still pretty ambivalent about an Imperius curse on a child who's obviously suffering this terrible torment, right? But he makes it quickly because he makes decisions like these every day. And McGonagall, absolutely. That's absolutely true with McGonagall, right? Like, she did not think twice about this because every day she's thinking about, how do I protect students? Every day she's been worried about Harry, but also not just worried about Harry, but also students like Marietta, right? So, like, it's not just like, it's not an instinct to just protect Harry in that room. It's any student in this room is her charge. And then she doesn't have to think or do the strategic thinking or this discernment because she discerns every day the action is habituated.
Yeah. I mean, we also see Harry's discernment come out, right? Which is like, take ownership, but also listen to Dumbledore, right?
Yeah,
like,
right.
And like, so you actually see both things in Harry, yeah. That like his first instinct is like, I'm just going to take the fall. I'm just going to be honest.
And defiance too, right? He's got this defiance against the ministry.
Yeah. But also checking in with Dumbledore. The thing I want to talk about with Marietta though is I think it is like almost a kindness that Shacklebolt takes the discernment away from her in this moment. She has been a sneak and has tattled and has this hex. And it's all complicated. But she in this moment is really, she did not mean to become a linchpin in like Harry maybe getting expelled, right? Like Umbridge pulling her in front of the Minister of Magic. Like we can assume a lot of bad intentions in Marietta here. I do not think that this is what she meant to have happen to her.
Yeah.
And the fact that Kingsley Shacklebolt literally takes her ability to make a decision away from her is not something that should be done. But I can imagine personally experiencing it as a kindness. When someone is like, do you know what? This decision is actually above your pay grade. Like, yeah. I have more information. I will do this for you. Because Umbridge is just using her. Everyone in this room is just using her. And again, like, I am not saying that what Kingsley does is just or good. I am just saying that sometimes there's so much to discern. And she thought she had discerned something, right? Rightly or wrongly, she thought she had looked at all the information and the right thing to do was to go to Umbridge and report on the DA. And now she's getting all this new information, including that there's a hex with sneak being written across her face. And I don't know. I would be like, well, now what do I do? I just, there's so many moments in my life where I'm like, could somebody please sweep in and just like tell me what to do? And Kingsley kind of does.
Yeah, right. You wish it could happen some way other than an unforgivable curse, right?
Yeah, but, no, I do. I do.
Yeah, I know you do, right? And but right, like what should happen is one of these adults should be like, obviously, go to the hospital wing.
Yeah.
Let's take care of you, right? Like, let's,
I
you've given us some information. It's our responsibility to find out more. Maybe you know other things. But like, the most important thing is not that you tell us this information in the next 15 seconds. You are obviously in distress and you've been hexed. Let's go take care of that, right? Like, no one's really taking care of Marietta except McGonagall right at the end, who sees a student in distress.
You know. Matt, I will say there was one thing that I noticed in this chapter that if I had noticed it before, I forgot, which is that this is the first time in the books that I think I've noticed a true disability accommodation. Harry is talking to Parvati and Lavender about going up to divination, and he's like, aren't you guys going up to the tower? And they're like, no, Dodo Brain, Frenzy can't climb a ladder. So like, that's not where divination is anymore. And I don't know. I just hadn't noticed that that is a disability accommodation. And I love that Hogwarts does it and does it so beautifully, like really sets up this like magicked, incredible space where he can do his teaching. It's not like, well, we found you a place that you can climb to. You're welcome, right? Like they still do a really good job. I don't think we have a ton of evidence that Hogwarts would do that. And so it's nice. You can imagine that Firenze probably did a lot of behind the scenes self-advocating, but.
Yeah, to tie to our last point, you don't get the sense that Hogwarts has habituated itself to these sorts of intuitions, right? It's not making it a habit of discerning the most equitable or best spaces for people of different abilities, but here they do it, and you're right, that's great.
Matt, today we're doing Lectio Divina, and I've picked a sentence at random for us, and here we go. He scooped up Dobby, who was still attempting to do himself serious injury, and ran with the elf in his arms to join the back of the queue. Oh, sigh. So Matt, step one of Lectio Divina is what is literally happening in the sentence.
So what is literally happening is Dobby has come to warn Dumbledore's army that Umbridge is onto them, that she has been given inside information and is on her way to the room of requirement to catch them all in the act of violating whichever educational decree they are violating. And, you know, although a free elf, Dobby is still suffering under the legacy of his enslavement. And so it's hard for him to say Umbridge's name. It's hard for him to tell Harry the truth. And so he's been like half revealing pieces of information and then running into a wall or hurting himself. And now that they've figured out what's going on, Harry's trying to protect him from himself and also just kind of get out of there with him to protect him from Umbridge.
Yeah, but like he joins the back of the queue, right? Like you can imagine, like Harry's a teacher.
Yeah.
And he's the one Umbridge wants most. So he could be like, guys, let me out of here.
Yeah.
And he also carries Dobby. I really find this sentence very sweet.
It's a very sweet sentence.
You know, we were just talking about this, but he's sort of in emergency mode, right? Like he just grabs Dobby. Like all of these instincts are coming out in Harry, and it's to grab Dobby and go to the back of the line. And you really see a lot of beautiful things come out in Harry here.
Yeah.
Step two is, what other stories does this remind you of? He scooped up Dobby, who was still attempting to do himself serious injury, and ran with the elf in his arms to join the back of the queue. Matt, I just read the book Bel Canto for the first time, the Anne Patchett book, and it is about a party that gets held hostage by a group of militants, and the hostage situation lasts for about 2 months, and it's a novel about many things, but one of the things that this novel, I think, is about is that alliances are complicated, and you can be emotionally allied with someone, and that doesn't mean that the power imbalance between the two of you has changed, right? You can care about someone with less power than you, but you still have more power than they do, and that, you know, human connection can do a lot, but it can't do everything. Like, it can't end systemic violence. And I just, this sentence really reminds me of that, that what Harry does with Dobby matters. The fact that he loves Dobby matters. The fact that he freed Dobby matters. The fact that he picks him up here matters. But like, also Dobby's trauma is like deeply ingrained and the house elf system is still reigning, and they can have this beautiful relationship, but no matter how beautiful their relationship is, like, these wrongs can't be righted. What about you?
Vanessa, the thing that I keep thinking of is The Wizard of Oz, which is actually not a movie I know very well or remember very well. But at the beginning of that movie, Dorothy and her little dog Toto are swept away by a tornado to the land of Oz. And the reason why they're swept away by a tornado to the land of Oz is because while the rest of the family is able to get into the cellar and be protected, Dorothy can't find Toto. So she's running around looking for Toto and trying to scoop up Toto so that Toto can be safe. And so like the scooping up thing was the thing that really stuck to me. And just like the image of a vulnerable creature who you feel responsible for, and like deciding for yourself that you are not going to be safe until that creature is safe.
Yeah.
It just reminded me of what's going on with Harry and Dobby here.
So Matt, the question now, of course, is what does this remind you of in your own life? He scooped up Dobby, who was still attempting to do himself serious injury, and ran with the elf in his arms to join the back of the queue. It reminds me of when fire alarms used to go off when I lived in the dorms. I had a dog while I lived in the dorms, and as I'm sure many people will remember from their dorm time, dorms are a place where fire alarms go off a lot. And I just permanently kept my front door unlocked because I was worried that I would not be home and a fire alarm would go off and that the alarm would drive my dog Rory up the wall. And I would tell my students that at the beginning of the year, like, hey, my door is always unlocked. If the fire alarm ever goes off, can you please make sure that Rory, like, exits with you? And I obviously don't know if this worked every time, but I would often come home to a note being like, there was a fire alarm. We grabbed Rory. She peed while we were outside, bought her back. And it just made me feel like really grateful to live in community, that I just knew that anyone would sort of scoop her up for me. What about you? What does this remind you of?
It's actually a related thought. The house we lived in before we moved up to this university house had faulty, like, fire alarm smoke detector system, which would go off all the time. And that was kind of irritating. We were in a rental. It was kind of irritating. But what it did do is it actually led us to have conversations with our kids about like what happens if there's a fire. Conversations we probably should have been having otherwise, right?
Yeah.
About like, how do you get out of the house? What happens if the way you think you're going to get out of the house is not a way you can get out of the house? And the sticking point for the kids was always like, who's getting Suki?
Yeah.
Dog, right? It's always like, who's responsible for making sure she gets out? And we had to be really clear with them. It's not you.
Yeah.
It is never you. Like, your responsibility is to get yourself out of the house. And yeah. Other people are going to worry about getting your siblings and getting Suki out of the house.
Yeah.
But just like that their instincts are the same place, right? Like, oh, there's somebody more vulnerable than me in the house. And yeah. I want to make sure that vulnerable person or that vulnerable creature is also paid attention to. Because we didn't have a firm answer, right? Like, because you don't know what's happening. You don't know in a fire or whatever, right? They might be saying, they want to know, okay, then who is it going to be if it's not me? And it's not a satisfying answer to be like, I don't know, maybe a firefighter, maybe one of us, but you don't worry.
But and they're not like, no. You.
But not you. And they're like, but I'm worried because you haven't told me who it is. It might need to be me. There's just that instinct to protect the vulnerable is there.
And yeah.
Yeah, that's it reminded me of that.
So step four, Matt, what does this make you feel called to? And I'll read the sentence. He scooped up Dobby, who was still attempting to do himself serious injury, and ran with the elf in his arms to join the back of the queue.
Can I tell you the sermon I would not preach? Put a little twist on it?
Please.
I mean, you know, on the one hand, the most obvious sermon to preach about this would be like, you know, remembering the vulnerable, remembering to attend to their vulnerabilities and that kind of thing. And I think I would not preach that sermon, or at least not like that, because it, you know, like vulnerable people are not puppies that need rescue, right?
No.
Like that analogy is
puppies are puppies.
That's right. Like it's like there's a like a level of like it's kind of patronizing to frame it that way, right?
Super patronizing. Yeah.
And so I think my initial instinct is to start there and be like, oh, that's a bad sermon. And I hope the sermon I would end up at would be something more like get in the back of the line.
Yeah, I know. I was thinking about that too.
Right. Instead of like, let me scoop up and be the hero of people who need my rescue. Instead of be like, oh, we're all trying to get out and I have whatever kinds of privileges I have. Let me get in the back of the line and make sure everyone gets out safe. Yeah.
When is it actually my job to be in the back? It's something I think about a lot because on pilgrimages, I like bring up the rear on hikes. And this past summer, that backfired because we had some slower walkers and I lost sight of the leader.
Yeah.
And so we got separated. And so, you know, it sounds simple. And I've always loved that about pilgrimages, that like my role is simple. I bring up the rear.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, oh, bringing up the rear is actually complicated. Like you need to be in really good communication with the front of the line.
Yeah.
And, you know, as a Z last name, I spent a lot of my childhood in the back of the line. I think about the back of the line a lot. And so... Yeah. Yeah, I just went, like, even the back of the line comes with responsibilities. It's not like, look, I'm in the back of the line. I've done my part. Like, even in line, you want to be a thinking person, right?
Yeah.
I think often you're like, now I'm in line, I can abdicate some control, but you always still want to be thinking.
Yeah. It's interesting that when I was in the Navy, the Marine Corps gunnery sergeants were the ones who would make us run around and train us and stuff. And the one thing they would say over and over again is lead from the front, lead from the front. And because they're talking about, like, going into a dangerous situation. So you lead from the front, right?
Right.
But I was thinking about it this past summer when we were in Japan. So crowded in Tokyo. Just like the number of people in a crowded train station. And I always wanted to be in the back so I could see everybody in front of me, right? And Clett was like, you're the tallest. You need to be in front so we can see you.
Yeah.
And you're also taller than all these other people. So so be in front so we can follow you, right? And like I was like, oh, I see. Like maybe what I need to do is like trust that somebody else will be in the back keeping track of us because what I bring to the situation is just visibility.
Height.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. It's you got to think about it. There can't be a rule on the line.
Yeah, that's right. Vanessa, thanks for leading Lectio Divina. It was a good one today.
My pleasure.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This week's voicemail is from Sophie.
Hi, this is Sophie calling in from Canada, and I wanted to hear your thoughts on symbiosis. And I say that because recently at work we were brainstorming theme ideas for an upcoming event, and symbiosis came up. I was curious about the etymology, and I was reflecting on how sim, I think, just means together, togetherness, and biosis refers to life or living. And usually we think of this in the context of science, where you've got different species sharing the same ecosystem and resources. And there's four kinds we usually hear about: mutualism, commensalism, parasitism, and competition. And I was trying to think of examples from the different books. And so for mutualism, where everyone involved benefits, I thought of the trio and their wider friend group. I also thought of Harry and Hedwig. There were lots of options there. For commensalism, where one benefits and one is unaffected, I sort of thought of Crookshanks and Sirius, because Crookshanks is really just being a cat. And Sirius benefits quite greatly from the relationship with Crookshanks and access to Peter. I also thought of the boys copying Hermione's homework, which kind of seems like parasitism, but in reality, it doesn't really do anything to Hermione, but the boys benefit greatly. For parasitism, I thought of the Horcrux that Harry is carrying around. I also thought of Umbridge and Rita Skeeter, because both of them sort of gain power and status while also doing harm to others in their community. And for competition, I thought of everyone trying to get dates for the Yule Ball. I thought of the Quidditch matches. I thought of the sort of dynamic with Gryffindor and Slytherin. And I'm curious if this might be an interesting lens for Vanessa and Matt to reflect on the different books and to try to think about the different sorts of relationships if we're viewing Hogwarts as an ecosystem. What's an example of commensalism, parasitism, competition, mutualism, and what your thoughts on all that are? Thank you. Bye.
Sophie, what a great voice memo. In my daughter's science, she was recently studying symbiosis. And as soon as you said symbiosis, I was like, mutualism, commensalism, parasitism. Because I don't remember learning that when I was a kid, and Cammie taught it to me. And I was like, oh, I didn't know what commensalism was. Like, I kind of figured out what mutualism and parasitism was, but commensalism was not one that I was familiar with. And you've done a great job talking about how some of these things might apply to the world of Harry Potter. You know, we're going to add symbiosis to the hopper for one of our potential episode themes. So keep your ears open. We're going to talk about symbiosis some week coming up.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Sophie. I'm now looking at a diagram of these different kinds of symbiosis.
It is now time for us to remember members of our community who have been loved and lost. John Charles Ziegler, who was 82, a beloved Peppa, with a jokester glint in his eye. Susan Anderson, who was 67, a mother, grandmother, community builder, and relationship nurturer. And Molly LeCaptain, who was 36, a singer, actor, crocheter, and storyteller. May their memories be a blessing.
Matt, we now get to offer blessings for characters in the chapter. Who would you like to bless?
I'm going to bless Hagrid for all the reasons I described earlier. Hagrid knows the stakes and knows the risks and is willing to risk certain things for others. And just like that kind of confidence and self-knowledge. And also just sort of, there's no self-pity in the decision either for Hagrid. He's just like, oh, this is what I have. And even if I may not like it, it's what's before me and I know what I ought to do. That's a tough situation to be in, and it takes some courage, and Hagrid's got plenty of that. So blessings to Hagrid. Vanessa, who are you blessing?
I'm going to bless Trelawney. This is sort of the week after the bad thing has happened to her. She's been fired from her job. She's sort of ostracized, and we find out from Lavender and Parvati that she's still really upset and that she is thinking about leaving. And I feel like often we will feel bad for someone or care about someone's misfortune for too short of a period of time. And so I just wanted to practice this thing of caring about her even when she's off the page, sort of a chapter after she's had this horrible thing happen to her.
Next week, we're going to be reading Book 5, Chapter 28, Snape's Worst Memory, through the theme of kindness with Casper Terkile.
Matt, before we give our thanks, we want to tell people that we are in the middle of a big fundraiser for On the Rise, an amazing organization in Cambridge, Massachusetts, that provides programming for homeless women, trans, and non-binary folks. If you want to learn more about our fundraiser, you can go to notsorryworks.com, and that is where you can also learn about all of our classes and pilgrimages that we have going on right now. This was a Not Sorry production. We are a feminist production company. Our executive producers are me, Vanessa Zoltan, and Caitlin Hoffmeister. We are edited and produced by AJ Yaramas, and our music is by Ivan Paisau and Nick Bull. We are distributed by Acast. A big thanks to Sophie for teaching us about symbiosis this week in their great voicemail. And thanks, of course, to Ariana Nettleman, Julia Argy, Margaret H. Wilson, Nikki Zoltan, Hannah Rehack, Casper Terkile, Courtney Brown, Natalie Folkert, Stephanie Falsell, and everyone who sent in the names of their loved ones. And Parvati was curling her eyelashes around her wand. How long are her eyelashes? How narrow is this wand? Okay.